BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. His commitment to and skill at diplomacy has defined his public life. In an age of febrile politics and politicians, he's known for his cool head. He's the first Norwegian to become Secretary General, a role he's held since 2014. Before that, he was the Prime Minister of Norway, twice. His second term in office included what he calls the darkest day of his life, when 77 people were murdered in a bomb attack in Oslo and a mass shooting on a nearby island. His response was to call for more openness and more democracy, but not naivete. Despite being born into a political family, he says it's unlikely that his schoolmates would have earmarked him as world leader material. He didn't learn to read until he was 10. He soon caught up, though. The first book he went for was a 900-page account of the Siege of Leningrad. He's also a former anti-war activist who once opposed his own country's membership of NATO. Now that he runs the 71-year-old alliance, he says, "I'm attracted by bringing countries together, working together, and especially in uncertain times, I think it's even more important that we try and sit down to find solutions through peaceful means." Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much. It's a great honour to be with you.
Calm global leadership has, of course, never been more important. How do you build successful alliances with President Trump, who has been critical of NATO and can be unpredictable when it comes to making his foreign policy announcements?
It's accepting that, yes, there are differences between the 30 allies, and there have been differences between NATO allies for as long as this alliance has existed, going back to the Suez Crisis in 1956, or when France decided to leave the military cooperation in NATO in the 1960s, or the Iraq War, which also divided NATO allies. But my message to President Trump, as my message is to all the NATO allies, is that North America and Europe has to stand together, especially when we see the rise of China, which is actually shifting the global balance of power. It's even more important that we stand together. And my message to the United States is also that, of course, NATO is good for Europe, but it's also good for the United States. Peace, stability in Europe adds also to the security of North America and the United States.
NATO celebrated its 70th anniversary last year, but many citizens of its member states don't actually know its history, should they?
It's not so very important that they know the history of NATO, but what is important is that they understand that peace is not something we can take for granted. Peace is something we need to protect and defend every day. Living in Brussels, it's a very stark reminder for me personally about how close war has been for such a long time. I'm living close to battlefields, like for instance Flanders Fields, and to go around there and to visit the cemeteries and see all the suffering, all the killing that took place there is a stark reminder of how brutal war is, and there are many of that kind of battlefields around Brussels.
We're about to hear your first disc, Secretary General. How important is music to you? Do you have much time to listen to it?
When I was younger, I listened a lot to music. I have less time now, but I still very much enjoy listening to music, and I have to admit that much of the music is the same music I listened to during the 1970s when I was young myself. But I also listened to, for instance, some Norwegian bands, and one of them is Madrugada and Lift Me Up, which is something I turn on when I really want to relax.
Lift me from the ground, and don't ever put me down. Don't pick a fight with me, just flip a coin, my love, you have won.
Lift Me Up, Madrugada and Anna Brun. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, you mentioned the rise of China as one of the biggest security challenges facing NATO. What else are you dealing with? What are the main challenges on that list?
For many, many years, NATO faced one big challenge, and that was the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The challenge now is that we're not faced with one challenge or one threat. We are faced with a lot of uncertainty and predictability. And I have always been very careful about predicting too much about what will be the next crisis, what will be the next threat we face. Because if you look to the past, experts have been very bad at predicting the future. Hardly anyone predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall. Hardly anyone predicted 9/11, which really changed our security environment. And as late as in the winter 2014, when I was asked to become Secretary General of NATO, very few had heard about ISIS. A few months later, they controlled big parts of Iraq and Syria, territory as big as the United Kingdom, 8 million people. And then Russia annexed Crimea, the first time borders have been changed in Europe since the end of the Cold War. One country annexed another part of another country. So for me, the important thing is not to list precisely what we think will be the next crisis, but more to be prepared for the unforeseen, be ready to act and adaptable when things are changing. And NATO is the most successful alliance in history, exactly because we have been able to change when the world is changing.
Has the pandemic affected NATO's operational readiness?
NATO's main task is to make sure that a health crisis, the COVID-19 crisis, does not become a security crisis. And we have been able to do that. Of course, we have adjusted some of the ways we do our activities, as like some protective measures, quarantine, and so on. But the main message is that we have been able to uphold the deterrence, defense, our operational presence throughout the pandemic.
It's time for your next disc, Secretary General. Tell us about this one. Why have you chosen it?
That's because I'm very proud of my children, as my son and my daughter. My daughter, Katarina, is together with another girl in a band called Schmerz. So they have established this band and they play all around the world. And I have to admit that the music is a bit different from the music I used to listen to in the 1970s. But Katarina has told me that a song called No Harm is perhaps the best song for the audience of this program. So then I choose No Harm. Say you know me, though I know you don't. First a friend, second, nothing's ever come all I wait for. Means it's too much, boys, too. I feel it, man. So tell me good lies. I know you got it in you. Like we're on only on, cause we grown up now. Tell me good lies. I know you got it in you. I'm gonna let go.
And No Harm. And I'm very glad that you included that one, Secretary General, because I saw them play live in London not long ago and they were absolutely fantastic. So let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Norway in 1959 to a family which already had quite a tradition of political activity. So your mother was a geneticist and politician, I believe, and your father was a diplomat. Tell us a little more about them.
My father was a diplomat, but then he ended up as a minister. He worked in the trade union movement for some years, and then he ended up as defense and later on foreign minister. My mother, she was a civil servant for many years, but she also was very political, and she served as a deputy minister for some years, and they're both social democrats or part of the labor movement in Norway. My mother was a very strong feminist, and she was one of the first to formulate a lot of what we call modern family policy in Norway about kindergartens, parental leave, gay marriage, and all these kind of reforms that modernized Norway in the 70s and 80s. Both of them have been extremely important for me, both personally, very close to me, but of course also politically, because they inspired me and I learned a lot from both of them.
So what was it like when you were young? Did you talk politics at home and were you encouraged to participate in those conversations?
So the reality is that they told me a lot about big and important events in history. The Second World War, at some stage I almost thought I lived through the Second World War because they told me so many stories about daily life, my grandfather in prison in Germany and so on, made me very interested in society, in the world around us. And then I ended up in the Young Labour Party as a 14-year-old boy, and since then I've been there. Not in the Young Labour Party, but in the Labour Party.
Was there a point that you realised that your parents weren't your average mum and dad?
So I realised at some stage that they were different than many others because they lived a different life. They both worked a lot. They both travelled a lot. And also my father, he had this idea or this concept of kitchen table diplomacy. So he brought back in our flat a lot of people from all over the world. In the 60s and the 70s, people leading different liberation movements in South Africa, from Mozambique and Angola. And later on, Nelson Mandela came to that kitchen table and sat there. And we were able, as children and then later on younger people, to meet all these political leaders from all around the world. My father had this idea of bringing people into his private home and then serving the breakfast was the best way to conduct as a diplomacy. The reality was that the breakfast was not very impressive. It was Norwegian mackerel and then some brown cheese. But the bread was quite okay because he had been out buying that the same morning. Mm. And he was quite good at making coffee. And then he served this. And the protocol, you know, in the Foreign Office, was a bit, they were always a bit shocked, but it worked very well.
Did that make an impression on you, that the informal approach to diplomacy?
But I thought that was a normal thing. So I thought it was an absolute normal thing to have, you know, freedom fighters at the kitchen table early in the morning. And some of them slept over. I think that was the way everyone grew up. So I actually was quite old when I realised that that was not normal.
It's time to hear your next piece of music, Secretary General. Tell us about it.
That's So Long, Marianne, with Leonard Cohen. And the reason why I have chosen that is that my mother married, so before she later on married my father, a Canadian poet in Montreal in the 1950s. And he knew another Canadian poet, and that was Leonard Cohen. And she became a friend of Leonard Cohen. And in 2008, I actually brought my mother to a concert in Oslo, where Marianne was also there. So it was Leonard Cohen, Karin Stoltenberg, my mother, and Marianne Ihlen, or Marianne. They were all together in Oslo, and then they were all in their 70s, and now they all have passed away.
Now so long, Marianne, it's time we began to laugh and cry and cry. Well, you know that I love to.
So long, Marianne. Leonard Cohen. Secretary General, you grew up with two sisters, and your eldest sister gave a TED talk recently in which she described you not learning to read until you were 10. Why did it take so long?
I really don't know, but I struggled a lot. I was not able to read. I was not able to write. I actually had problems with speaking. I stuttered. And if you saw me when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I was also a bit fat. So there was nothing with me that indicated that I should become party leader, prime minister and secretary general of NATO. But I had my parents supported me. I went to something called Rudolf Steiner School in Oslo. Mm. They accepted that I was a bit different. And suddenly I started to learn. So my first book was then to read 900 Days about the Siege of Leningrad. And since then, of course, I have appreciated very much the ability to read books.
Yes, you caught up very quickly. As a teenager, you were quite active in protesting against the Vietnam War. What did you do?
It was my bigger sister who brought me into that. And she brought me into, when we were very young, into the movement protesting against the Vietnam War. And I don't regret that because a lot of bad things happened. And it was the protests against the Vietnam War all over the world that helped to end that war.
So your political passion was kindled very early. Was there ever a different career that you seriously considered?
Absolutely. I, in one way, only made one deliberate decision regarding my career, and that is not to become a politician. So I finished my studies at the University of Oslo in statistics and mathematics economics, and I started to work in the research department in the Central Bureau of Statistics in Oslo. And my main focus was to become a professor in statistics and economics. But then I was asked by the the Minister for Environment back in 1990 whether I would like to become his Deputy Minister or State Secretary. And then I said yes, and I promised my wife and myself only to do that for a year or two and then to go back to mathematics and statistics. But now I've been in politics since then, so my academic career is quite limited and not very impressive either.
Time for your next piece of music, Secretary General. What are we going to hear and why?
We are going to hear Bruce Springsteen, partly because I like him, but the main reason why I'm going to listen to this specific song, Hungry Heart, is that he was in a small town, or a town outside Oslo, giving a concert in the beginning of the 1980s. And then one girl was then taken from the audience up to on the stage, and he danced with her. And that girl was my little sister, Nini. And then the song was Hungry Heart when they were dancing at the stage, Nini and Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen and Hungry Heart for your younger sister, Nini, Secretary General. She very sadly passed away in 2014 from drug-related problems. How do you choose to remember her?
The strange thing is that I only remember the bright sides of her life. We actually shared bedrooms, so we slept in the same room for many, many years. We were very close. We traveled a lot to Latin America together. And she was beautiful, also really, really beautiful. And she was extremely brilliant, very intelligent. But then when she was also in late 20s, she started to get a drug problem and she ended up as a drug addict. And she passed away when she was in her early 50s. And for me, it will always be a paradox and something I will never be able to explain why in a family with three children, my bigger sister, Camilla, she ends up as a medical doctor, a professor. She's now the director of the Norwegian Public Health Agency, working with the COVID-19. I end up as a prime minister and secretary general of NATO. And then my little sister, growing up in the same room as I did, in the same streets with the same friends, attending the same school, she ends up as a drug addict and passes away much too early.
You were very much in the public eye during the time of her troubles. You were the Prime Minister of Norway when she passed away. How much help were you able to give her?
Of course, not enough. I tried. I know my bigger sister did a lot to help, try to help her, both as a sister but also as a medical doctor. But especially my parents, they spent years and years to try to help her in different ways. And very often we thought that she was on her way out of the drug problems. We saw some progress, and especially my parents, they always convinced themselves that this time it's different. This time she's really able to stop using drugs, but every time we ended up being disappointed. Mm. After a few years, it was very public that she had a drug problem. So she became kind of the public Norwegian voice for people with drug problems. And she got a lot of sympathy, but not least my parents, the whole family, we received letters, support. We were stopped at the streets from other family members of people with drug problem, because some of the shame, some of the all the efforts to try to hide was taken away when one of the well-known family in Norway was so open and Nini was so open about the drug problems. So just by becoming a public voice, standing up for the rights of people who have drug problems, and Nini actually played a political role and helped to change the policies in Norway on how to deal with drug problems.
In what way, and how did she shape the policies?
Mainly by helping to make this not an issue which was regarded as a criminal issue for police, but more as a health issue for the health services. And that was perhaps the most important thing she did. The other thing she did for me personally is that she taught me about how the Norwegian society looks like from the bottom. Also, I was sitting there at the top as prime minister, and of course I traveled around, but of course when the prime minister arrives, everything is a bit changed. But then when I met my sister for family dinners or for a coffee, then she told me about how the Norwegian society, which we normally look upon as a very successful, good, inclusive society, actually how bad it was for those who are at the bottom of that society. So I still, when I walk in the streets of Oslo, I can see people with drug problems coming to me, and they tell me about Nini, and they feel that they know me, so they stop me and we talk, and they convey the same message that it was important to have Nini as a voice on behalf of their cause.
We've got to go to the music. It's disc number 5. What have you chosen and why?
We are going to hear something that actually my wife told me to choose, and I have great respect for her. She's a strong woman, and she's a diplomat in her own rights. So I always listen to her, and she told me that we should actually choose a song which is a Bob Dylan song, but it is delivered by Arne Brun, and this is Make You Feel My Love. And the important thing with this song is also that it was played in the BBC series Normal People, which is now extremely popular in Norway.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I could offer a warm embrace to make you feel my love. When evening shatters and the stars appear, and there is no one there to dry your tears, I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love.
Arne Brun, Make You Feel My Love. Secretary General, you were Prime Minister of Norway twice. During your second term, Norway experienced a day which shocked the whole world. On the 22nd of July 2011, 8 people were killed when a bomb exploded outside your office in Oslo, and then 69 young people were killed in a mass shooting on the island of Utøya. What are your memories of that day?
Of course, the memories are very dark. It's about killing, it's about death, it's about brutality. But the paradox with the 22nd of July is that it's both the darkest day of my life, of Norway's history after the Second World War, the most violent day we have experienced since the Second World War. But it also mobilized the best things in the Norwegian society. Love, solidarity, and the ability to support and comfort each other. So 22nd of July is something very bad, but it also demonstrated the best and the brightest sides of the Norwegian society. Of course, the victims are those who lost their lives and those who lost their loved ones. I was very close to many of them because partly I was working in the building where the first bomb exploded, and then the mass shooting took place at this island Utøya. And that's an island where the Young Labour Party has had summer camps for decades. I have been there every summer since 1974, so I in one way grew up on that island. And then I was actually going there the day after the attacks, and many of the people that were killed were friends and people I have known for many years. So it was a brutal day, but also a day where we saw the importance of standing together.
As families waited for news on that day, sometimes hearing the worst, you were there with them. How do you comfort someone in a situation like that?
It is very hard, but just to be there, to hug people, to talk about those who are passed away, share good memories. And I also try to continue to contact at least some of them. So I call, meet them still, and call them also before Christmas, before the 22nd of July. So I think it's important to remember that many Norwegians, of course, 22nd of July 2011 is now a long time ago. But for those people who are really affected, this is something which is still very present. There's still a child missing, a brother not there, or a family member who has passed away much too early. So I think it's important to remember to show comfort also long after the loss.
It's time for your sixth disc, Secretary General. What are we going to hear and why have you chosen this?
We are going to hear Til Ungdommen, and that's To the Youth. It's a Norwegian song, and it's Ingeborg Bratland. She's going to sing it. She also sang this song, actually, in the cathedral when we had the commemoration a few days after the terrorist attacks in 2011. And this song became, in one way, the symbol of the 22nd of July, and almost all Norwegians are able to sing it, and it's a song with a very strong message about peace, about being against violence, and the trust in the future.
Ingeborg Bratland and Til Ungdommen recorded specially for this programme. Secretary General, outside of politics, you have a passion for cross-country skiing. You went to Antarctica and skied to the South Pole in 2011 to celebrate the centenary of the first Norwegian reaching it. What was that experience like?
To be at the South Pole is like being on another planet. It's 3,000 metres of thick ice. It was minus 30 or 40 degrees. The sun was, you know, standing in the middle above your head all the time, and it's extremely beautiful. I like to say that I have skied to the South Pole, but that's not entirely correct, because we actually went in with a big aircraft and landed there at the scientific base. But then I got some skis, and I skied, I guess, 2-3 kilometers from the South Pole, and then I skied back. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I've skied to the South Pole. But when you say that in Norway, they think that you actually skied from the sea also, and then for weeks living in a tent and skiing all the way to the South Pole. I have not done that.
Another interest of yours is vaccination and global child health. You were director of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunisation, Gavi, working alongside Bill Gates and Nelson Mandela. So many people talk about the Mandela effect. What was your experience of it during that time?
Nelson Mandela led the whole effort. And to see him being so strong on these issues, of course, inspired me, inspired many other people, and just demonstrate the greatness of Mandela. I also had the great privilege of being able to invite him to a big concert. The concert was called 46664. That's the prison number of Nelson Mandela when he served his sentence in prisons. And that was a concert in Tromsø, north of the Arctic Circle. We brought him from South Africa to northern Norway. And we had people like Annie Lennox and Peter Gabriel there. This was in June 2005. And I remember the artists, they wanted all to be at the stage when it was dark, when the sun had gone down. But I tried to tell them that it will not be dark, because in the northern Norway we have midnight sun. So we ended up with Nelson Mandela, Annie Lennox, Peter Gabriel and many others on the stage with, you know, snow on the mountains, sun shining down on all of us, and then the barren sea outside the stadium where we had the concert. So that was a great night, and we stayed awake the whole night, and Nelson Mandela gave a great speech, and it was a great concert, and everyone in Tromsø remembers that concert even today.
And did he remember you as the little boy at the breakfast table?
He said so. Whether that's correct or not, I don't know. But he's a good politician, so he knew that that was the right thing to say.
It's time for your next piece of music. What are we going to hear?
Free Nelson Mandela. And it's important for me because I grew up with that song as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Norway. But of course, important for the movement all over the world. And then meeting Nelson Mandela later in life. That is an important song for me, but also for many other people all around the world.
Special AKA and Free Nelson Mandela. Secretary General, I'm about to cast you away to a solitary life on your desert island. What do you hope it'll be like?
I think I would like to actually go to an Arctic island, because for me to stay on the beach where it's very hot, that's something I will not like to do for many hours. If I can go to an Arctic island, I can then at least combine that with my favorite sport, cross-country skiing. Mm. And therefore, if it's possible, I would actually choose to go to an Arctic island.
I don't see why not. Now, we've all been a bit more isolated than usual lately, I think. I wonder whether your experience of lockdown has taught you anything about yourself.
It has actually taught me that I don't like to be isolated. I'm a very social person, both when it comes to private social life, my wife, my family, my friends, but also when it comes to working. Also, I like to be in the same room as the people I work with. If we are going to discuss a text or a message or whatever, of course, we can do that on phone. We can do it on video conferences and so on, but it's not the same. If I'm going to read, I can be alone. Then I can sit and read. But as soon as I'm going to do something more to be creative or to try to shape or to formulate something, then I like to be together with others and discuss and interact.
We're going to hear just one more disc from you today. What's it going to be and why have you chosen this?
This artist is a friend of mine. I have known her for many years. It's also because she's very much connected to this island, Utøya, where we had this mass shooting in 2011. She has played there many, many times. And then she is also a great artist. So Ingrid Olava from Up Here.
Olava and From Up Here. So, Secretary General, I'm sending you away with three books. You can have the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and another book of your choosing. What will that be?
I think actually that would be a textbook in statistics, partly because I really want to study statistics. That was my favorite subject before I left the Central Bureau of Statistics and moved into politics in 1990. But also because actually it's extremely time-consuming to read textbooks in statistics. You can spend days just reading and learning and understanding 3-4 pages. So if I only have one book, I think I can spend a lot of time on that. While if the alternative is some kind of novel or some other normal book, I will read it in a few days and then I don't have anything more to read. So a textbook in statistics is something that I can comfort me and give me something to do for many, many days.
It's wonderful, a wonderful choice and all yours. So it does quite sound a little intense, an Arctic island with a book on statistics. So I think we'd also better give you a luxury item, something to make your stay more enjoyable on the island. What would you like?
It is obvious that that has to be a pair of skis because on an Arctic island, that's the only way to move across the snow. And it's also the only way to have some kind of activity. So a pair of skis would be a great luxury item for me to have on that Arctic island.
They're yours. And finally, which one of these discs would you save above all the others if you had to?
Til Ungdommen, Ingeborg Bratland, because it symbolizes so much about everything I care about. So that's the song I would like to keep.
Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, thank you very much for letting us hear your desert island discs.
Thank you again for having me.
Hello. I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. You'll have heard him refer to the time that he spent working with Nelson Mandela and Bill Gates on the global vaccination program. Bill Gates was cast away to our island by Kirsty Young back in 2016, and you can find his brilliant programme in our archive and if you search through BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be legendary DJ Annie Nightingale. I do hope you'll join us.
Bloodsport is the story of how the Russian state doped the 2012 Olympics and everything that followed.
2012 was just bit of a kick in the nuts. I don't know.
A lot of us naively believed that we were through the worst of it.
That had been placed here by the Kremlin to try to find Dr. Rodchenkov.
City of London.
They could have stopped that. They had the information.
The smoking gun.
They had the sources.
No, I'm just clarifying.
Yeah. The most extraordinary sports story
deny.
All time.
How many people were working in the laboratory then, though, at that time? Did
well,
you?
We were working in shifts.
Yeah.
Russian doping control is like fake doping control.
So join me, Matt Magendie, as we tell the complete story for the first time.
They're incredibly brave people, aren't they?
That's Bloodsport, How Russia Doped the 2012 Olympics. You can subscribe to it on BBC Sounds.